Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you know I listen to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
Come on, let's see you.
No, it's in there. Trust
dance,
me.
Ladies.
Not that one.
Oh, I like it. I like the moment.
No. Definitely not that one.
Dance, ladies. Come on, take a chance.
Hey, up, you pop craze youngsters. And welcome to part two of episode 56 of Chart Music. I'm your host, Al Needham, and the party is starting to rev up. Sarah's currently ripping through my tape box looking for the Christmas 1983 Top of the Pops, and well, Taylor seems to have nested in the drinks cabinet, but never mind, we'll get him out in a bit, and you're here, and that's all that matters. So all that remains to be said is, oh, who the fuck's that now? Fucking hell, it's Neil Kulkarni.
Hello there,
in,
boys.
Neil.
Hey, all right. Hello there,
Happy
boys.
Happy New Year.
Hey. How are we?
We're all good. All the better for seeing you.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, I hope you don't mind me dropping round.
No, come on in. Sit down. Get on the settee.
We're thinking of watching an old episode of Top of the Pops.
Yeah, why not?
So, Neil, just by the look of you, it looks like you've got a big bulging sack of pop and interesting things. Why don't you come and ram them into me stocking?
Hey, you know what? It's not been a bad Christmas at all.
Excellent.
Considering my day, you know, my Christmas day started with a big slug of Cointreau.
Good lad.
Yeah, well, left it out for Santa. Lightweight bastard, didn't even touch it.
Ugh.
Or the mince pie, to be fair. So I had to knock that back. And the day ended with a fairly equally sized slug of Jack Daniels. It went surprisingly well. Booze does help, doesn't it, at Christmas?
It does. It's great.
It really does. And I've got some pretty good presents as well.
Oh.
Including, not exactly poppin' interesting, an air fryer, which I believe is, it's this year's posture corrector, I'm telling you. It's going to be the thing that's going to, it's going to enable me to lose my birthright as an Asian man and change my body shape from the pot belly and skinny legs that all Asian men have to something a little more svelte. I'm allowed to say that, by the way, it's not racist. And it's Christmas. So, yeah. Good presents, nice booze. I am kind of
What's
falling...
What's the first thing that's went into the air fryer?
I think it's got to be chips, hasn't it?
Yeah,
it's got to be chips going in there.
I hope it's chips. It's chips.
I hope it's chips. I am kind of falling into that dad / granddad thing of being the guy who's asleep on special occasions, usually by about 2 p.m. But that's, you know, booze does make everything better at Christmas. I'm now looking at all my decorations because I've got 2 rooms full of Christmas tat, wondering whether it would be too brutal to take them down already. But yeah, I'm in the festive spirit this year.
I've one normal room and I've one Christmas room.
Yeah, maybe.
So, Neil, Christmas 1983.
Well,
must be frosted with beautiful memories.
Well, you know what I really remember? Because normally I can remember what presents I got and all this sort of stuff. What I remember is it's a really strange memory. But I remember staring at a luminescent clock for 2 hours from 4 a.m. on Christmas Day through to, you know, of course, I didn't have a fucking phone to go on or a tablet or a laptop to go on. It's 1983. And I got up too early because I was in that in-between time. You know, I was 11.
Mm.
So I was dead in between, kind of still getting really excited about Christmas.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, but also a little bit of that adolescent disinterest that you affect later on. So I woke up really early, like I always did, like at 4 o'clock or something. Yeah. Whereas ordinarily, you know, perhaps when I was 10 or 9 or whatever, I might have gone and bothered my parents to ask if I could open my presents. I just remorselessly stared at this clock until it turned into a time. So it's burned in my memory. Just that it was one of those luminescent kind of bedside ones that looked like it should go with the Goblin Tees, mate.
Ooh, did it say West Clocks on it?
It may well have done. And it was luminescent. Just watching that. It's startling how many memories I have in my life of just trying to force time to pass quicker. It's weird because when I remember, I was thinking the other day, most of my memories of the 90s are actually of getting the train back from London to Cove and knowing that it takes exactly 13 minutes to get from Rugby to Coventry. Mm. And as soon as the wheels started rolling out of Rugby, I'd start counting to 780. That's my memory of much of the 90s. And my memory of 83 Christmas, yeah. I can't remember what I got. I can't remember what I watched on telly. I can't remember if my parents were about that day. I just remember remorselessly staring at a clock, trying to make time go faster. It doesn't work, of course. No. It just makes it drag. But ho-hum, yeah, that's my main memory from that year.
Beautiful. Anyway, why don't you come and sit down for a bit and look, we'll get stuck into this.
Oh, yes, please.
All right then, Pop Craze youngsters. This is now time to go way back to Christmas Day of 1983. Always remember, we may coat down your favourite band or artist, but we never forget they've been on Top of the Pops more than we have.
First, an end of the year reflection of Top of the Pops 1983.
It's 2 p.m. on Sunday, December the 25th, 1983, and as is the lore of the time, the Christmas episode of Top of the Pops is about to commence, but not before we get a flash of the 1983 BBC One ident, the last incarnation of the big snowflake, which has rotating fronds or whatever. It's nice, isn't it?
It's lovely.
The BBC One ident, we used to get it about 6 o'clock on Christmas Eve, and that was it then.
Yeah.
When you saw that, Christmas was on, bitch.
Yeah. Yeah, and no cutesy claymation animation or any of that shit.
No.
Thank God.
I fucking hate it when they do it in November now, man. It ain't right. This is what pisses me off about Christmas. Everyone lumps into it too early. And by the time it comes, it's like, oh, this again.
Yeah, yeah. Hence, it loses its specialness somewhat.
Exactly.
It's all about the frenzy of Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
Christmas Eve is the most volcanically exciting day of the year as a child. I'm not sure it is anymore, but no. Christ, I'm an old bastard.
So once again, chaps, Top of the Pops is stuck in the 2 p.m. slot, which is the most awkward fucking time, isn't it?
Yeah.
We've mentioned this before. It's just evil putting it on at that time.
Where's that awful dead spot in Christmas Day, where it's that cold stillness and pale light outside and, like, that eerie silence all over the estate, you know what I mean? All these crappy house front Christmas decorations flashing on and off to no effect in the bleak daylight, just wasting that precious electricity. And then, like, there's, like, one car going past every 3 or 4 minutes, like, going somewhere that no one in the car wants to go. And that's where the Christmas Top of the Pops would always sit. And it is a very un-pop atmosphere, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, but where could they schedule it? I mean, to be honest with you, on Christmas Day, I wouldn't want to wait until the evening for it.
No.
So, yeah, perhaps a little bit earlier, midday, something like that.
Yeah, well, they did that this year, didn't they?
Yeah, it's just chucking it away, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's...
No one cares.
Yeah, well, no one does care now, do they? So yeah. They got the scheduling right just when it didn't matter anymore. But, you know, it wasn't always on at 2 p.m. And I think it's time for a potted history of the Top of the Pops Christmas show.
Okay.
Come and sit by the fire and let the old man tell you a story. Unbelievably, there was no Christmas Day Top of the Pops in 1964, the year it came into being, but the episode on Thursday the 24th was expanded out to an hour and was a showcase for the biggest hits of the year, a format which remains to this day. It was also given a slot in that year's Christmas Night with the Stars, BBC One's annual showcase of its stars and sitcoms. The entirety of it was given over to the Barren Knights, doing impressions of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. The first proper Christmas Day Top of the Pops in 1965 went out at 10:35 in the evening, went on for an hour and a quarter, and was repeated the next day at a quarter past noon for the benefit of the youth. In 1966, it was shamefully put back to Boxing Day, the only other time it was locked out of the Christmas Day schedule, but it was also the first time it was shown over two parts, both going out at 6:15 p.m. In 1967, it was slotted into the 2 p.m. slot on Christmas Day, fucking up Christmas dinner arrangements right across the country. The BBC, in a rare lapse of sense, brought the 1968 show forward to 1:35, followed by the black and white minstrel show, meaning it was the turn of racist Nance to want their dinner putting in the oven. From 1969 to 1971, Christmas Top of the Pops ran from 2:15 to 3 o'clock, establishing itself as a de facto programme to put on before the Queen's Christmas message, expanded out by 5 minutes from 1972 and finally going back to a full hour in 1978. Although Top of the Pops finished 14 years ago, it still makes an appearance on the BBC One Christmas Day schedule. It was on at 5 to noon for an hour, between something called Zog and something else called The News. So, chaps, what would have been the ideal time for Top of the Pops on Christmas Day? I'm going for about 4 o'clock. You know, after your dinner's gone down and after everyone else over 30's passed out in an armchair.
Sort of tucked in just before Disney time kind of slot you're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah. That might have been ideal. I mean, I think we all had to work around it, didn't we? I got used to it being at 2 o'clock. So it did become a bit of a yearly tradition. But yeah, that horrible thing that sometimes happened at Christmas where you actually had to be dragged away from it to the dinner table.
Yes.
Oh, horrible times.
Yeah, you couldn't have the telly on while you're having your Christmas dinner.
Yeah, well.
That's wrong, man.
Well, I mean, I suppose I should have been the same this year. I did Christmas dinner at mine, had the kids round and all that. And, you know, I suppose I did insist no tablets, no phones at the table. What the fuck am I turning into? I should have just let them be on it.
Hitler. So today we are blessed with four hosts. In order, number one, of course, could only be Simon Bates, who has just clocked up his 6th year in the mid-morning slot and is pulling down 11 million listeners a day. He's been in the news this month for being photographed while giving Paul McCartney a cheque from the BBC for 2 pence. It's the royalties for one of his singles being played for a musical contribution to Radio 1's Merseyside Week earlier in the year. Alas, he's lost his other presenting job. Unbelievably, he was the host of the first ever series of Food and Drink on BBC Two in 1982. Who the fuck knew that? Yeah. And has been replaced by Henry Keller. But he's recently appeared on The Vintage Quiz, a looks familiar type show only available in the TVS region with Charlie Chester and Sharon Davis. But rest assured, because he's making another very special guest appearance on BBC One over the Christmas period. Oh, Christmas without Simon Bates, man. It's like sex without drills.
Well, he, as we've said before about the master, you know, he's avuncular, reassuring. He does say, you know, don't worry, no matter how madcap and zany things get, he's going to keep a firm hand on the rudder and ensure it doesn't slip into, you know, senseless, ugly carnage.
Your next host is Janice Long, who took over from Peter Powell in the drive time slot this March and is into her first full year as a Top of the Pops presenter and would be the only woman allowed to do the man's work of saying the names of bands and singers for the next 5 years on the Pops.
She's fun and she's looking good in this episode too.
Yes, she's all done out as, is it Dick Whittington?
I think it's Dick Whittington, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, or just a sort of generic principal boy.
Yeah.
But she's very odd tonight, isn't she? There's a definite edge to her.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit of lewdness.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
A few suggestive comments. Most uncharacteristic. Like she's been at the Sherry Trifle. And it's good to see. But yeah. It is also a little bit like your mum twerking. I don't know what's got into her. But fuck it, it's Christmas and yeah. The 80s are not going to get any sexier. So you might as well make the most of the moment.
Yeah, yes. She looks good. And I like the sauciness she's got with her slap of my thigh outfit and stuff. Mm. And she's the person you want to be with at the party, at the Christmas party. You know, probably the person who would probably end up slagging off Simon Bates as soon as she got a chance. When you're in the kitchen by yourself. But she looks great, and the lewd comments she makes throughout it provide, for me, the only dadisfaction in this episode, to be honest with you.
I mean, as we all know, Simon Bates was not a popular man at Radio 1, and according to John Peel, the first thing people did when they attended the Radio 1 Christmas party was check the seating arrangements to see how far away they were from Simon Bates. Wasn't it John Peel and Kid Jensen and Andy Peebles who decided that they were going to beat Simon Bates up in the car park?
Yes, supposedly.
Then decided not to. I bet fucking Janice was in their ears, goading them on.
Or leave it, he's not worth it.
Yes. The third in line dressed up as a pantomime dame is Mike Smith, who has been promoted up from the 6 to 7am pre-breakfast show slot to the lunchtime slot in May. He's also been popping up on the new BBC Breakfast Time show as an occasional presenter whenever something pop and interesting needed talking about. He's also made his acting debut this year as a radio DJ on Night Kids, a play about two homeless girls in London, which was part of the series Live from Pebble Mill. I think this partly answers the question why Mike Smith didn't want his Top of the Pops as repeated.
Yeah, his widow twanky thing here. It just sounds like he's been kicked in the balls, to be honest with you, this first joke that he attempts. And he is kind of using this momentary transvestitism as an excuse to aggressively sexually proposition male colleagues that he's harboured silent, latent thoughts about. So often the way when a massively heterosexual man dresses as a woman.
Yeah.
But yeah.
We're still in the, a man in a dress, tee-hee-hee phase, aren't we?
We are,
culturally.
Definitely.
But it does end up looking like they told Mike Smith it was fancy dress. And he's the only one who turned up wearing it. Like, it's like the older boys have probably got it down in their contracts that, you know, pale coloured sports jackets only, you know. Like Bates would have issued a public statement. I feel that such costumes are not in keeping with the dignity of my status as a professional broadcaster. So it's like just Mike Smith just turned up and looked around and immediately thought, oh, shit. And because Janice is a nice person, she's gone and found a hat from somewhere, just stuck it on top of the perfectly ordinary 1983 clothes he was wearing before, just try and make him feel better.
He's a weird one, Mike Smith, isn't he? Smitty, who could forget the plaintive cry of Sarah Green on Ghostwatch?
Edmund's enabler.
But, you know, he's not so much the forgotten man of Radio 1, but he's kind of like the man who knew too much in a way. The Dr. David Kelly of BBC Light Entertainment. I mean, I know he ends up a success. I know that. He ends up running flying TV, you know, hiring helicopters out.
Yeah.
And he also, of course, coined it in from the Carphone Warehouse shares that he took as payment for a Carphone Warehouse ad. Yeah, very lucrative in the long run. But, you know, you do sense, I always sense, perhaps this is me imagining it, but that he knew secrets, you know, and that there's a reason Noel doesn't invite him back to house party after that murder, what they'd done. I mean, you know, I mean, that terrible accident, of course, where an audience member died. But, you know, Smith presented, didn't he, on that show, The Live Stuff Outside. And I think he got tarnished by that. And even though Noel had told him not to talk about it to the press, it was Noel who immediately just started hawking his fake grief. And still stayed hired.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and I know that caused a massive rift between them. So Smitty's an interesting one. He was thoroughly conventional at the time, in a sense, and I would have appreciated him as that as a child. But ever since, yeah, it gets dark, doesn't it, with him?
And the fourth host, who else? Andy Peebles, who at this point is still the second to last person to interview John Lennon before he was shot. Actually, he's currently holding down the 7 p.m. slot on Friday nights, presenting the Get a Pop Star to Pick Their Favourite Singles show, My Top 12, on Saturday afternoons, and the evening show, Andy Peebles on Sunday, on Sundays, presented by Andy Peebles.
Yeah, well, nothing says Christmas like Andy Peebles. They should have replaced his spherical head with a Christmas pudding just for the day. Yeah. Tip-top custard on it.
Yeah, I mean, we've only covered Andy Peebles once so far, me, you and David Taylor.
Yeah.
At the time, he, you know, as David rightly pointed out, he looked like Paul Bearer and a grub in a suit. But he's beefed out a bit since then, hasn't he? Fucking hell.
Well, he's had to, just to survive at Radio 1.
In 1983, Andy Peebles looks like a dad who's got on stars in their eyes as 90s-era George Michael.
He does look odd. He looks like some kind of weird mix of a sort of Garth Marenghi and some kind of East End villain in a way.
Yes.
Like some counterfeiter called Inky Peebles. You could do you a really diamond-type passport, but he also might shank you for getting the name of a Teddy Pendergrass B-side wrong. he's an odd presence here. I used to like The Quiet Storm and his show. I used to like his show. His voice is great, and he's a great creator of mood on his radio shows. But he's really demonstrative of how kind of, you know, good radio presenters don't necessarily make great TV presenters as well. I mean, I'm glad he's here.
Yeah.
But he's, to be honest with you, he's extraneous, isn't he? Yeah. As, to be honest, is bait. I mean, I think Janice Long and Smitty could have coped, but I guess these elder statesmen are there to reassure the very little kiddies and the old folks that it's all going to be okay.
Yes. No one's going to be licking shit off anyone's boots on Christmas Day.
But yeah, absolutely no pantomime costume for Peebles.
All good to God.
No. I reckon what happened was when Smith realised he was the only one dressed up, he looked like he was going to cry and went off and kicked a big hole in his dressing room door. And then Peebles went in and pointed a little stubby index finger right in his face and said, "Hey, chopper squad, I like your frock. Was it a present from your boyfriend?" And Smith just stared at the floor. He was like shamefaced. And he turned around to walk away. But then Peebles reached out, grabbed him by the shoulder and spun him back round and repeated it. He said, "Hey, chopper squad, I said I like your dress. Was it a present from your boyfriend?" But luckily at that moment, Michael Hurl walked in. Like, or Bullet Hurl, as they used to call him. And Peebles just disappeared. Like a mouse when the light goes on. Yeah, no, Hurl was like, "Everything all right, Mike?" And he was like, "Yes, sir, everything's fine." But that's why, years later, Smith ended up flying Sarah Green into a tree, because he was in the copter and he saw a full moon and got a Nam-style flashback to Peebles' perfectly round face, and he just glazed over and aimed the copter straight at the ground, like with All Along the Watchtower playing in his head. Mike.
I mean, all four of them together, it's a very weird setup, isn't it? I mean, gone are the days when
it is.
You know, we were happy to see Noel and DLT sitting around an oversized turkey.
Yeah, but they used to divvy it up, didn't they? They used to give the young people presenters sort of one episode and the old farts another episode. This is, it seems excess to requirements for all these four presenters.
Yeah.
Were it a sandwich, not that I need food analogies for everything, but if it were, I think what we have here is a kind of slightly, we've got two slightly dull doorsteps of white bread sandwiching some kind of bold, new, exciting 80s faces.
Open
it's place. Like sort of two Findus crispy pancakes yes. in a mother's pride bed, if you like.
But, I mean, for the four of them together, that it's as if the accounts department have drifted off from the Christmas do and have somehow find themselves in a nightclub for the first time in a decade. And I mean, Bates and Peebles look particularly out of place.
Mm.
You just see them there with, amongst all the neon and the noise and everything. And you just start thinking, oh, man, something's going to go really fucking wrong here.
Oh, it's odd that Peebles even wanted the gig, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Whose nostrils did he threaten to split to get this spot? That's what I want to know.
I mean, this was a standard Yellow Hurl ploy at the time, wasn't it? Bung on as many presenters as you can.
Mm.
I mean, the second part of the review of 1983 would feature Peter Powell, Tommy Vance, Richard Skinner, Gary Davis and Adrian John. Proper lads' night out, if you will.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they're trying to show the diversity on Radio 1. You know, lots of white men and one woman. But to me, it just goes to show that there are no standout Radio 1 personalities anymore.
Yeah.
You know, why are they sending a Bates and Peebles and Smith and Long to do a Travis's job?
Yeah, well, there was this sort of slow fade, wasn't there, from the early 80s on, where, first of all, Radio 1 DJs kind of lost their status as the gods of light entertainment. And then they sort of became these gentle, sweater-wearing blandies. Then they started to be phased out of presenting Top of the Pops at all. Then finally, the knock on the 12-bedroom Berkshire mansion door at midnight.
Yeah.
In a way, it was more insulting what happened later, right? Like, it's pretty insulting to be served up Dave Lee Travis with the on the understanding that you're going to like him. But
yes,
it was sort of worse that afterwards, when it's like Radio 1 DJs are meant to be just like you, except richer, you know?
And
it's
yes.
Like, as opposed to what we grew up with, where the whole point was they weren't like you. Like, whatever they were, they weren't like you. And it's like, you know, on the one hand, like, almost any price was worth paying to secure the downfall of those, you know, failed human experiments and turbo ship machines. But it wasn't necessarily progress, because in the end, what really did for people like Bates and DLT was not their crimes against media. It was their difference. It was the fact that they were freaks and their inability to fit in unobtrusively. Do you know what I mean? And so I think 1983, it's like the start of the discouragement of freaks and oddballs generally, you know.
Mm.
Mike fucking Smith, I ask you. Like a smug lamb.
I mean, there's no Dave Lee Travis on either show, but, you know, he is still part of our Christmas in 1983. He plays a trombone on the Woolworths advert. You know, the one with Joe Brown as a ringmaster, Rula Lenska, Susie Birchall out of Coronation Street, Daley Thompson, Lenny Bennett, Eric Bristow and Jeff Capes.
What a lineup.
Yeah.
You know what, though? You know what Radio 1 people would have been talking about in the playground the next day?
Mm.
Bates well fancies Janice still.
Yes.
It's so blatant, man. He's got his arm around her at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally blatant.
And, of course, you can imagine Savile with his feet up at Checkers telling Maggie Thatcher what a bunch of cunts these lot are.
Happy Christmas afternoon, and welcome to a real pantomime of Top of the Pops, but it's star-studded.
Merry Christmas, I'm the principal boy, this is Michelle.
Hello. I'm just so glad you could all come to the ball.
Yes, Mike Smith is going to be making a dame nuisance of himself all afternoon. Let's start with a hit from 1983, back to July, here's Freeze, and I owe you.
Yellow Carla Pearl kicks in, we're hit with a cascade of gold bubbles, a Christmas 83 logo, and are confronted by Bates, Long, Smith and Peebles underneath a massive Christmas 83 logo, while a bloke in a brown jumper and a policeman's tash talks with his mate in the background. They all concentrate on getting their appalling introductory lines out, such as, "This is Michelle, and Mike Smith is going to be making a dame nuisance of himself." Finally, Peebles half-arsedly points at the stage and introduces the first single of the night, IOU by Freeze. Formed in London in 1978, Freeze began life as one of the best-known bands in the burgeoning Britfunk movement, which emanated from southern England during the Aventies. They self-funded their debut single, Keep in Touch, in 1979, and after that they signed a one-shot deal with Pye Records, and the single got to number 49 in June of 1980. After the follow-up, Stay, failed to chart, they signed to Beggar's Banquet at the end of the year, and their next single, Southern Freeze, hit the jackpot when it got to number 8 for 2 weeks in March of 1981. The follow-up, Flying High, got to number 35 in May of 1981, but their next two singles flopped and they dropped off the radar for 2 years, trimming down to a two-piece, lead singer John Rocker and bassist Peter Mars. However, in early 1983, they linked up with the New York producer Arthur Baker, who had scored massive hits with Planet Rock for Afrika Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force, and Walking on Sunshine for Rocker's Revenge, and he wrote them this single, which entered the top 40 at number 23 in June, then soared 16 places to number 7, and then slowly and methodically scaled the top 10, and eventually spent 3 weeks at number 2 in late July, early August, held off the top by Wherever I Lay My Hat, That's My Home by Paul Young. And that, gentlemen, is fucking criminal, because this, especially teamed with a video, absolutely screams the summer of 83.
Yeah.
Isn't it fucking brilliant?
Yes.
It is great. I mean, my first thought when I saw it, because I don't think I'd ever seen this Top of the Pops appearance before, it's the record that I'd mainly heard on the radio, was, where the fuck are they all? You know, there's only three people on stage. I mean, it happens in this period that a lot of these funk collectives simply don't need as many people anymore.
No.
The same thing kind of happens to Lynx. It goes without saying for me that Southern Freeze is 10 billion times better than this. But this is a strangely prophetic record. It really does predict the 80s a lot. A lot of what's going to happen. So even though Arthur Baker's production sounds kind of dated now, at the time, there weren't really that many electro records in the charts. And a lot of those Brit funksters, if you like, those Brit jazz funkers, they are looking to change electronically. When I think of what Paul Harcastle does a couple of years later, you know, and he's coming from the same kind of thing. And what, you know, listening to this, which of course is a tune that we're all really familiar with, what really struck me was how eerily reminiscent of Static and Waterman it was. How sort of it predicted their kind of dominance later in the decade. There is one thing wrong with the record, and that's the spoken word bit.
Yes.
I mean, fuck me, how did that pass Arthur Baker's muster? That was not a good idea.
No.
But I mean, it's just in your head instantly, this record.
Yes.
Yeah.
Instantly.
1983 might be one of the best years for summer songs. I mean, Juicy Fruit, Cruel Summer, Long Hot Summer, All Night Long, the Mary Jane Girls version, Club Tropicana, Temptation, The Sun Goes Down, Waiting for a Train, Love Town, The Crown, Rocket, Get Down Saturday Night, Tour de France, Hip Hop Bebop, Don't Stop, and this. I mean, for fuck's sake, I just want to bung all of that onto a tape. Find some youth skulking about in the shopping precinct and just chuck it in the fucking face and tell them that my formative years pisses in the mouth of theirs. Yeah. And if they ain't got anything to play that tape on, it's their tough shit for being born in such a shithole century. It's fucking brilliant, man. I hear this and I'm back in the summer of 83.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like sort of as Neil alluded to, the only thing wrong with it is that because it's credited to Freeze, the three E's stand for extra exciting energy.
extra exciting electro.
Yeah, but it means that you have to compare it in your head, whether you want to or not, to Southern Freeze, which does it no favours, because that is a better record. But this one doesn't have that sort of that great sullen, untutored vocal that Southern Freeze.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Southern Freeze, although Southern Freeze is very of its time, the backing track sounds more sort of timeless because it's just like a nice sort of nice funk track. Whereas this is, as you say, so 1983 that now it sounds slightly dated. But I think that's a good thing, because if you're making a pop single, it's good to make it sound like the year that it comes out.
Yeah. Mm,
mm. Rather than sort of trying to sound timeless, which you just end up sounding smug, you know. But it is a comparison you can't make him. But if this was a single by another group, or even by the same people, but they'd given themselves a different name, like if they called themselves Goose Juice or, you know, the Bugger Grips or something, then you could see how great it really is, despite the efforts of various people on the stage, because they're not a visually appealing group.
No.
No, they're not, are they?
No. No.
They look like they're being played by Trevor and Simon. Yes. There's a definite resemblance there, especially the singer. And there's that keyboard player in, like, X-Men shades. Like,
yes.
He's going to try and post a letter into his eyes. But, the singer slightly spoils this record. Well, not spoils, but just maybe take something away from it, because this is not a personality record, right? This is a producer's record.
The
personality that comes across here is that of Arthur Baker. But there's some producer's records which deliberately leave a big space for a big personality performance, like Two Tribes, you know, or You Spin Me Round, right? Or like Leader of the Pack or something. It's still a producer's record, but the whole point is you have a big personality there in the middle. This one doesn't. All you have to do is go in and sing it and not ruin it. And his actual singing is passable, but, I mean, the whole sort of camp male singer in a white singlet bit is like a foreshadowing of Erasure, but without their personal likability.
Mm.
Yeah, he's essentially dressed up as a male gymnast, isn't he? All in white. With a singlet. Yeah, he could have done something on some pommel horses or something during the middle eight or whatever.
Do you reckon the keyboard player is actually Arthur Baker?
Nah.
Could be.
You reckon?
Arthur Baker's a hairy fucker. Yeah. Arthur Baker had a lot of hair.
It could have been Peepoo, though. Robo Peepoo.
But, I mean, that would have annoyed me. I mean, watching it kind of, they're not a stage. They're not good on stage, in a sense.
No.
In that, you know, I mean, I shouldn't expect, you know, documentary-like reality with this stuff. But you know, clearly, this is a record not played or touched by anyone on this stage, in a sense. Mm. Yeah. The bass player's playing a bass line you can't hear. The keyboardist is playing all these two-handed chords you can't hear. He'd have been better off just using one finger, you know, and just punching
Ed Miliband on guitar there.
The one thing that I do like about the singer, despite the fact that he looks like Andy Bell out of Erasure if his tailor was Georgia Asda. Andy Bellend, if you will. I like the fact that he's not actually athletic enough to get away with his athletic-type outfit.
No.
Because if you look, his tight white vest is just slightly hanging over the waistband of his white trousers. And there's just a little bit of tip jiggle when he does that jigging about.
You can pinch more than an inch.
Yeah, and he's got his shoulders a bit too far back. And his knees are pointing in opposite directions when he does his marching back and forth dance, you know. And it's a hard performance to pin down or to understand what he thinks he's doing. You know, and that's before you get to that talk over, which is, it's got to be the least appealing talk over on any record in history. It's the way he goes, "And girl, I know you care. I'll never love another." It's like a heroic pledge of undying love delivered like something you'd hear in a minicab office in Goole at 3:10 in the morning. Like, after he's done it, he should keel over to one side and be sick into his girlfriend's cupped hands so they don't have to pay the driver for cleaning the upholstery.
Oh, man. I know at least one person who enjoyed that spoken bit. Because, I mean, this was the fucking anthem at my school.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one lad, and his shtick was to pick a girl he fancied out at the playground and then just drop to his knees and then bellow that bit out while everyone else just pissed themselves laughing. I suppose it's a bit better than getting your cock out, waving it.
Marginally.
But not by much.
Yeah. Was he wearing a string vest, though?
No.
Surely, it's for any kind of pop group, rule one is no vests.
Yeah, unless you're in the Funboy 3.
Oh, I was just thinking, has any good pop music ever been made in a vest? Yeah, okay, Funboy 3, the drumming at Live at Pompeii, and this. Mm. I think that's it.
Yeah. No one's done it in vest and pants, though. Yeah. That's still something for the groups of today to reach for. Imagination could have done it in vest and pants.
Could have done it in just their vests. Forget the pants. But I mean, yeah, the thing is, though, just to reiterate, it's a fucking genius producer's record. And the reason it is because when it gets to the hook, which is already going to be Velcroed into your head, Arthur Baker just makes everything do the hook. Like, you can hear all kinds of different things doing the hook until it's, like, drilled into your skull. It's so murderously effective, this record, in getting the hook across. Yeah, absolute genius.
And I'll tell you something else as well, a little glimpse into why this record is so good. I only found this out at random when I was fast-forwarding through the episode. But if you drop in just here and there and play a tiny split-second section of it, like a... you know, as you're skipping through. And you can do this with any record. Just listen to, like, a quick snippet, too short to hear any melody or any words. Just one beat. Just you get a snapshot of what your brain hears at a sort of animal level, like the frequencies and the basic sort of sonic shape of the record without the actual melody getting in the way, like the mechanical sound of the track.
Mm-hmm.
And what you normally hear when you do that is like a sort of a booming sound or a rushing sound or a or something like that. But with this, you hear like a cacophony. It's this really harsh clash of tones. So it's this whole record with a catchy tune and a danceable sound, and it's built out of awful noise, arranged really carefully, like sort of metal pipes banging together sort of noise. And that's why it catches your ear, because it's really sweet and poppy. But the actual fabric of the sound of the track is as harsh and as aggressive as You Really Got Me or something, you know.
Which is not
true of a lot of the other superficially similar dance records from this sort of time.
Yeah, it's got that maximalist thing. It's like when we were talking about You Spin Me Round, actually. I think definitely Stark Aitken and Waterman are listening to stuff like this. Yeah. Because it's got that set everything to stun thing. It's not really a record with space, but you don't have a choice in the matter. Once it's on, this is getting in your head and it's going to stay there the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's late 1983, but it's got to be said that in this episode, the zoo wankerishness, which could have been absolutely jacked up to the maximum, it's been damped down quite a bit, hasn't it, Neil?
Yeah, it has a bit. They're not foregrounded as much, for starters. Mm. And also,
they are there.
They are there, but they're not foregrounded. They're not all of them doing the same shitty-ass strolling moves that they've done for fucking years. And actually, some of the music in this episode, I'm not saying it was made for Zoo, but it kind of suits, in a sense, some of their styles a little bit better. They're not, it just doesn't seem so artificial, but mainly you can't see their fucking faces. You can't see their expressions. And that's what's key. I mean, one of the maddening things about Zoo was always the idiot joy on their faces. You can't see that. They're mainly in silhouette.
I mean, they do have dancers for this performance, but they're not Zoo wankers, are they? They're actually break dancers who know what they're on with.
Yeah, popping and locking and all of that, yeah, and they're doing it well.
Nothing massively spectacular, but by late 1983 standards, it's like, oh, fucking hell, look at them.
Yeah.
Look at them now, all spinning on the back and everything. Isn't it good?
Yeah. First year, I mean, I seem to recall 83 being the first year that sort of those street sounds comps come out. So yeah, definitely the year of that. And yeah, it was great that it was on Top of the Pops. And there is quite a bit throughout the show actually of that, which is good to see.
I mean, this 1983 is the year that Jeffrey Daniel came out on his own for A Night to Remember, which is one of the definitive Top of the Pops performances.
Yeah, really the only thing wrong with this is that they didn't show the video instead. It would have been much better.
Yeah.
I mean, because that video, like the record, is a nice reminder of the days when each individual year had its very own distinct character. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm.
And I discovered from the comments underneath that video on YouTube that apparently everyone always thought the lyrics to this song went A-E-A-E-I-O-U and sometimes Y. Which, of course, would have made a lot more sense.
So Freeze would follow up I-O-U with another collaboration with Arthur Baker, Pop Goes My Love, and it got to number 26 in October. But they closed out the year with Love's Gonna Get You, only getting to number 80 last month. John Rocker left the band in 1984 and they split up a year later. However, I.O.U. enjoyed a second life when it was used in the 1984 hip-hop film Beat Street, and a remix version was put out in 1987 when it got to number 23 for 2 weeks in January of that year.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to All Rather Mysterious, the podcast that aims to unlock the mysteries of the past with the key of fact. My name is John Rain.
My name is Eleanor Morton.
My name is David Reed.
Please join us as we present to you mysteries that have baffled the world.
You had any noises?
What about a door creaking?
You don't have to do it.
That weird kadoonk that lights going off makes for some reason in films.
All Rather Mysterious.
Freeze and I.O.U. from 1983. And 1983 has really been a renaissance year for Michael Jackson. With Billie Jean, he had a number one hit and it was fantastic, but the video was something else.
In his... Oh, hang on. Is that the doorbell, Taylor? Do you want to get it?
Oh, can't you get it?
Oh, fucking hell. Simon, come on in, mate. How are you?
Hello, ho, ho. Nadolig Llawen.
All right.
Yeah, how you doing?
Happy new whatever it is, Simon.
I can't believe you're sitting around watching an old Top of the Pops.
I mean, know, it's terrible, isn't it?
Isn't that just a bit of a busman's holiday, a bit much like the day job? but
come
why
on
not,
in.
Eh?
Get your scent of sherry. Or say, you appear to be dressed like Ian Asprey, Simon. What's going on there?
Yeah, I kind of slept in my costume from last night, in which I was an online interactive event, which, let me just say, that is my idea of hell. But at least it was online. You know those sort of immersive theatre things or like murder mystery things that sometimes you get roped into quite often as a sort of team building exercise.
Yeah.
It was a friend's birthday and I had to take part in this kind of like, you know, murder mystery thing. And the theme was conspiracy, cult or corporate. So obviously only one word jumped out at me there. And you know me, I didn't have to dig too deep in my wardrobe to find a sort of frilly musketeer shirt, some tight white jeans and a black wig and a paisley headband and a fuckload of rosary beads. So yeah, that was the photo that delighted all my Facebook friends last night.
Can I share it with the Pop Craze youngsters?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yay! So, Simon, Christmas 1983.
Yeah.
Any memories?
It's funny. We've literally discussed the episode 3 days before this one. Neil and I did it, I think, episode 16.
The week before.
Yeah, yeah.
The week before this one. We've already done that episode.
Yeah, and it was
Here Comes Jism.
Here Comes Jism, the episode that gave us that immortal chart music meme. Yeah, so I've already talked about where I was at in my life quite a lot. I even re-listened to it just to check.
Let the Pop Craze Youngsters go back to that episode.
Then go find all that. So, you know, yeah, I talked a lot about how I gained acceptance through the twin-pronged attack of a cardigan and being funny. But the other thing that I sort of remember that I didn't mention that time was just... My knowledge of music in itself became a thing to make me popular. I remember because I was just such a sort of music geek, and that gave me a huge amount of respect at that time. Rather than, you know, it could have made me kind of laughing stock. What's wrong with this guy? But
that time it wouldn't.
No, I mean, I was known for this encyclopedic knowledge. People used to try and catch me out at school. I remember this one kid coming up to me and saying, "All right, then." And he thought he had a really good one here. Right? So, "All right, then. I bet you can't name the lead singer of Echo and the Bunnymen." And this was, I think, possibly the Bunnymen hadn't quite started having hits yet, but they were quite a known band. And, you know, he thought that was a really obscure one. And quick as a flash, I played Ian McCulloch. And he just walked away like...
Smack!
Yeah, yeah. And he walked away sort of like shaking his head, like, you know, like, this guy, fucking hell.
Yeah.
It was so easy. So, yeah, cardigans, jokes, and knowing about music meant that I could relax a bit more.
That's what you want out of life, innit?
Yeah, yeah. It meant I could walk home from school without wondering who's going to jump out at me, you know, wondering what foe may assail me on the walk. Things had relaxed a little bit by then. So it was quite a nice year, yeah.
Good. And this is a fucking corking episode, isn't it?
Sorry, Al, I don't know what you mean. You mean this episode that I've just walked into your living room and you happen to have on?
Yeah, of course, yes. Yeah. Well, it's been good so far, even though there's only been one song.
Yeah, I remember it exactly the episode you mean. It's almost as if I watched it yesterday. yeah, it's still a time when what's in the charts and my own tastes haven't parted ways significantly. So, you know, my own taste was a real scattering of things without any particular central focus, like ABC, Culture Club, Style Council, Dexys, Big Country, Madness still hanging on in there. I had a brief brief Joe Boxer's phase, wearing a string vest. things like The Smiths and The Cure were just starting to appear on my radar, but I hadn't gone alternative yet. I was very much a smash hits kid, and 1983 is very much a smash hits year, and I think... That sort of vibrancy of pop does come over in this Christmas episode. Also, I hate it when people try and retrospectively cool wash their tastes. So I'm going to admit here that two of my most played albums of 1983 were Labour of Love by UB40 and No Parley by Paul Young.
Yes.
But both albums which people don't tend to say, oh yeah, of course I was into No Parley and Labour of Love. But, you know, can't change the facts. That's what was on my... turntables at that time. And there's plenty of stuff in this TOTP that having fought my usual battle with my elder relatives to even get to see it on Christmas Day, because they thought we should just sit around maybe playing charades, telling stories of old, and maybe watching The Queen. That's the only thing we allowed to watch was The Queen.
Talking about the fucking good old days.
Yeah,
Jesus.
So
you'd want to do that.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So, having won that battle, I would have thought it was worth the fight, because there's enough decent stuff on here to enjoy.
So let's continue then. Bates, in his supply teacher jacket and a tinselly lei, surrounded by the kids and a scattering of members of City Farm, tells us that it's been a renaissance year for the next artist and that we really need to check out the video. It's Billie Jean by Michael Jackson. We've covered Michael Jackson many a time and oft on chart music, and this single was the follow-up to The Girl Is Mine, the duet with Paul McCartney, which got to number 3 in November of 1982. According to the biographer J. Randy Taraborelli, it's based on a woman who sent Jackson a string of letters throughout 1981 claiming that Jackson was the father of one of her twins, culminating in her sending a photo of her, a gun, and a letter telling him to kill himself at a particular date and time, and that she'd do the same to the baby and herself so they could all be together in the afterlife. So Jackson naturally did what all of us would and hung the picture up in his family's dining room.
You know.
According to Jackson, he was so obsessed by the song that while it was going through his head on the way to sessions for Thriller, he didn't notice that his car had caught fire. It was put out as the second single off Thriller in January of this year, and in the first week of March it became the number one in America, where it stayed for 7 weeks, and then became his second solo number one in the UK after She's Out of My Life, when it deposed Too Shy by Kajagoogoo. Seeing as Michael is about to have his Christmas dinner underneath a photo of his stalker in America, we get to see the video directed by Steve Barron, who did the videos for Strange Town, When You're Young and Going Underground for the Jam, Time for Action by Secret Affair, Ant Music by Adam and the Ants, Maid of Orleans for OMD, Stepping Out by Joe Jackson, Love Action and Don't You Want Me by The Human League, Promised You a Miracle for Simple Minds, It Ain't What You Do, It's the Way That You Do It for The Fun Boy 3 and Bananarama, and Africa by Toto. Fucking hell, there's a CV.
Yeah.
Or a show reel, if you will.
I mean, some of those are sort of bog standard doing the job videos, but Take On Me by A-ha. That is a solid gold classic. Just very innovative, obviously.
Oh, he did that later on, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, fucking hell, it still shocks me that this fucking song was not the first thing we heard off Thriller. And he went with The Girl Is Mine with Paul McCartney.
It's weird, but I suppose in a way, sort of hooking himself onto Paul McCartney's legend status was a signal, a sign really of how, almost how low Jackson's own reputation had fallen at that time, because obviously we're talking about an era when things moved so quickly that 3 years was an eternity.
Yeah.
And I mean, previously, like everyone else, well, maybe not everyone else, but I'd loved Off the Wall, especially the title track, but that felt like a million years ago by late 82. So he comes back doing a duet with McCartney and it's almost like, oh yeah, remember him. And certainly, so this is Billie Jean, you know, second single off the album, but his first kind of solo single, if you like.
Yes.
There's no guarantee it was going to be number one just because it was Michael Jackson. Do you know what I mean?
No, not at all.
At that time, it wasn't a banker. It wasn't even nailed on that it would be a hit at all. Plenty of stars of the disco era were now struggling even to crack the top 40. And we're talking about people who had huge hits in 78, 79. So everything was kind of up for grabs. And, you know, Thriller had only come out a couple of months before this single came out. They brought it out in January, which is always the trick, isn't it, to get a cheap number one?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because there's hardly anything else about. So CBS thought, look, you know, we need to get this guy a big hit. Let's just bounce it out there where there's very little competition.
Mm.
And it worked. And it's weird to think of that now, because this became his biggest selling single ever. And it's, you know, one of the defining tunes of his career and of the 1980s.
Yeah.
But it is worth remembering that the success of this track, which now seems so obvious, was not obvious at that time.
I mean, I remember being absolutely shocked when it got to number one.
Yeah.
And another thing as well is that around about this time when the Style Council started up, I joined the fan club, the Torch Society, and they'd send out kind of like newslettery things every now and then. And I remember reading it and it's saying, oh, you know, congratulations to Michael Jackson to getting to number one with Billie Jean or something like that. Yeah. And I was absolutely shocked that Paul Weller liked this song.
Right, yeah.
And that was the kind of like barometer for me at the time. Well, if Paul Weller don't like it, I don't.
Yeah. It is surprising though, you're right. Thing is, he did seem kind of an old-fashioned figure, something from a previous age when he turns up. Simon Bates goes on about what a great video this is, and it's probably just hindsight. But you look at it now and think, is it? Is it really?
No.
I mean, they threw a lot of money at it, I guess, by that era's standards. But It's very corny. There's very corny sort of detective mystery angle to it. You know, Jacko being pursued by a private detective slash paparazzo who sets off a Polaroid camera, but guess what? When the picture comes out, Jacko's not in it and all that. But it does seem the sort of production values that you would now expect bare minimum from a shiny floored ITV Saturday evening dance routine, you know?
Yeah.
It's got a big cat in it, fair enough. Any 80s video with a big cat is a winner as far as I'm concerned. You got a panther in Hall & Oates Maneater, and Adam and the Ants, Prince Charming, of course, in which Diana Dawes waves a wand and a normal cat turns into a panther. And that's kind of what happens here. You've got a cat. It jumps behind a dustbin, the sort of dustbin that you only see in sort of American fiction, like in...
Where Top Cat lives.
Top Cat, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yes.
And it comes out the other side and it's a fucking tiger. Or at first, is it a tiger or is it like a sort of ocelot or something a bit smaller? then finally at the very end is this huge fucking cat. But yeah, it's a bit underwhelming through modern eyes, perhaps.
Yeah. But at the time, I mean, Bates can tell us all he wants to watch the video, but if you're a pop-crazed youngster in 1983, you could just shut your eyes and you could see virtually every frame of this in your head.
Well, yeah.
Because it got played a lot. Yeah.
That's the thing.
And at the time, it was, oh my God, look how glossy and mad this is.
It's interesting to me how memorable every second of this video is to me. And not just this video, almost everything in this episode, because I didn't have a VHS recorder. I didn't even know anyone who had one at that time, or maybe one kid. You know, you had to sort of, you maybe see these videos three or four times if you watched every music program and you happened to catch them, if you were lucky.
Yeah.
And you just, they just sort of imprinted themselves on your retina. It's really interesting how, whether that's a sign of the era or the impressionable age that we were at that time. Yeah. But yeah, Jacko seems almost like a kind of a figure from the golden age of MGM musicals or something like that. There's a bit of a kind of Bob Hope or Gene Kelly kind of feel to him. Even his trousers, right? He's got his trousers, they're a bit half-mast. They're a bit, so to show the white socks and to show off his footwork. But they've also got a very slight flair, though, a very slight kick flair on them. And you know me, I was the Matthew Hopkins of flares. I was the Saxon Finder General at my school.
Saxon Finder General.
Going around my school, shaming kids who had a slight flare on their trousers. And I would definitely have shamed Jacko for his trousers had he been at my school. If he'd been at my school, of course, there would have been all kinds of eyebrows raised for all sorts of reasons, but let's not go into that. If one of my friends had expressed even a liking for Michael Jackson, that would have made them a flared person in my mind. I'm going, flares, you like Michael Jackson. And you know, I've been on about what he looks like and so on and what the video looks like. And it's obviously him stepping on a paving stone and it lights up was mind blowing at the time. We can't take that away from it. That was so fucking cool. But there was something...
It was like Nightmare, wasn't it? Like a kid's game show.
I suppose the precursor for something like that would have been the lit-up dance floor in Saturday Night Fever. But that was just making random patterns. That wasn't responding to the dancer and where they put their feet, which is just, To this day, you watch it and think, okay, that is pretty fly. That is, and his dancing, even though it is that old school Gene Kelly kind of dancing, it is brilliant. You've got to say, you know, it's. I don't think I valued dancing as an art much in those days. I just thought, oh, whatever, you know, all right, stop showing off. But it is pretty fucking incredible, some of the stuff he does. But again, old fashioned, because we've just seen Freeze doing IOU with breakdancing in it. So straight after that, you've got this guy doing normal, traditional, fancy footwork, and like an old-fashioned hoofer, and it does seem dated. And in a way, that applies to the record as well. So, all right, Quincy Jones production, you can't really argue with that, written by Jacko himself. But there's something it's very hi-hatty, it's very trebly, there's not a lot of bass or oomph to it as a dance record. Obviously, it's danceable, but it's a move on from disco. It's not, you know, this isn't a record you could have imagined sitting on Off the Wall or any album of that era.
No.
But it doesn't really point the way forward either. It's hard to think of much that was influenced by Billie Jean. It's one of these weird anomalies in pop that is one of the biggest records of the decade.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a sort of a full stop or a question mark on its own, I think.
What Bates actually says at the start is the record is fantastic, but the video is something else. So he might not have actually been bigging it up, because video really isn't that fantastic. And I like the cats in it, but yeah, you're right. It probably was pioneering at the time, but it just pioneered and broke ground for a load of other videos with stylized city sets and coloured lighting and stuff. But the bit I do like is when he's going up the stairs and there's some graffiti on the wall behind him, which says Viz Rules. Which is
hang
pretty
on, does
hit
it, though?
For 1983, but he was a very early adopter. Right. He liked Skinhead and Paul Wicker, the tall vicar. He used to get it from the Gosforth Hotel on Salters Road.
Yeah, old Trent House.
What I think is so amazing about this record is that it seems to be driven by inexplicable magic, because when you look at all the component parts, it shouldn't be quite this good, because it's not got that much of a tune. The beat is quite pedestrian compared to a lot of Off the Wall. And yet it is mind-blowingly great. It's like some interdimensional being has blown on it and created some unearthly internal illumination. And I'm tempted to suggest that that interdimensional being was called Quincy Jones, which is not to play down the contribution of the bad king of pop. But to me, this is another producer's record. That atmosphere of tension and brooding anxiety is so strong and so beautifully controlled by the rhythm track, and it just glows and seethes in a manner that's so subtle that you can listen to it 1,000 times and you can either dissolve into the darkness or just groove on it and dance and be happy. And when people gripe about commercialism in pop music, which in itself is a hilarious missing of the point, I would always direct them to this record, which wouldn't be this record if it was allowed to run free and if its entire sound and structure were not so carefully constructed to create a worldwide radio smash hit. It's the discipline and concision that's instilled by having to think about this and having to think about other people, basically, and balance your creativity and your innovation with a basic popular appeal. It's the main driver of greatness in popular music, and it's why this is what it is. It isn't jazz. It's simultaneously something easier and harder. It isn't funk. Mm. It's something simultaneously easier and harder and better and worse. And I think the key to understanding this record, how it actually works as a piece of music, is its deep similarities to I Heard It Through the Grapevine, which musically does precisely the same thing that this record does. And I don't know whether that's conscious or a coincidence, but there are uncanny similarities which go beyond the, you know, there's like a brooding bass line and very similar string sections. And I think if you study those similarities, it can teach anyone a lot about arrangement and production, like however much they already knew, you know. Although I sometimes wonder if the air of darkness and paranoia on Billie Jean is helped, perhaps subliminally, at least for British people, by the almost exact resemblance between that string shiver that appears out of nowhere in the chorus and the electronic, for want of a better word, jingle on the Protect and Survive adverts with Patrick Allen. Right. You know the ones that would wrap your nan in polythene and leave her in a crater?
Yes.
I mean, I'm 100% sure that's a coincidence, but it is quite a creepy one.
I thought we were going to come to nuclear paranoia a little bit later in the episode, but it rears its head. Yeah. That's a really good comparison with Heard It Through Grapevine. Hadn't thought of that before. Obviously, I'm now going to ruin Taylor's really good Viz joke by talking about what it really says in the graffiti on the stairwell, which is the Wiz rules.
Oh.
Wiz rules, which, of course, a reference to the 1978 adaptation of The Wizard of Oz, in which Michael Jackson plays the Scarecrow. Now, the thing with the Wiz is that Jackson got fairly good reviews himself. And he said doing that film was the greatest experience of his life to that point. But critics hated it. Yeah. So that this little thing in the video, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to think where it says Wiz rules. It's not some random bit of graffiti. That it is, you know, he's basically saying screw you to the critics.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if the Wiz came out now? Can you imagine the response on social media and the comment sections of tabloid newspapers? Well, it's like The Wizard of Oz, but there's one big difference. Yeah. Not sure that would go down too well with certain sectors of society. No.
Yeah, yeah.
Fuck
Ghostbusters.
Them.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, it's always bothered me about Thriller, right? Like, Thriller, obviously, is a great album. It's where the 80s really got started. It's not anticipating the 80s or pointing the way towards anything. It just is that thing. It's already started, and every part is moving freely. It's like, here you are. Here is the decade you're living in. I don't know whether what I'm saying here is shit and ancient, hacky student stand-up material. Right, like mocking the grammar in Live and Let Die. But I've never seen anyone point this out. So tell me, this film genre that he's referencing in the song Thriller with zombies and monsters and evil things lurking in the moonlight, that's not a thriller, that's a horror. It's a completely different genre. His second favourite genre, but the first is not legally available in the United States. It's like if he'd done a song about men in black bowler hats bumping into each other and falling off stepladders and landing arse first in barrels of water on scratchy black and white film. And then the chorus went, it's a sci-fi. Yeah. It's just no.
Satire.
Someone should have said, Mr. Tempest.
Fair enough, yeah.
Thank
if
you
anything, it's the Billy... It's the Billie Jean video that's more like a thrill, or even that's more of a film noir kind of thing going on. Yeah.
And speaking of titles, did he not think there was a slight issue with the title here? One very famous person called Billie Jean who was even more unlikely to have had Michael Jackson's child than he was to have fathered it. And the song's narrative is completely dependent on you never making that connection in your head, lest you big bird it forever, right?
I mean,
it's like
straight away
for me.
I came
out with a song called Nigella, and I went, no, it's just about a girl called Nigella who can't cook.
Yeah, totally. I mean, at the time...
He did Dirty Diana as well, remember?
Well, yeah, of course. It's just any sort of Diana. Yeah, Billie Jean King, totally. That's what I thought straight away when this record came out. It's like, why is he singing about Billie Jean King? What the fuck? Because nobody had heard of any other Billie Jeans.
Yeah.
And I guess to this day, I still haven't, really, yeah.
No.
Yeah. And dodging accusations about his private life, of course, would become... a theme throughout his later career.
Get him in early.
Yeah.
This must be the first time that sex has reared its head in a Michael Jackson song.
I guess so, yeah.
I don't want to look too deep into Ben.
Oh, God.
That's not what he said.
Ironically, when Michael Jackson did eventually father children of his own, the sort of suspicion of the paternity suit in the court of public opinion, let's say, was that they weren't his kids, you know?
Yeah.
So, of course, 10 years after this, he could have had the DNA test live on Jerry Springer rather than going to all the trouble of doing a song about it.
Yes.
This video, of course, is hugely significant in terms of MTV as well.
Of course, yes.
They wouldn't show it. I mean, they just weren't showing black artists.
No.
And Walter Yetnikoff, the president of CBS, had to bully them into playing it, quite rightly, He was going to go public and, you know, tell the world that they weren't playing this guy because he's a black artist. And he was going to pull all of CBS's artists off MTV, David Bowie, of course, called out MTV's racist policies.
That's amazing, that clip, isn't it?
He that interview on rocket. The channel itself. Yeah, yeah. It's
or a tin can, as he would call it.
Well done. Well done. you know, so eventually MTV put it on heavy rotation. The first 52, I think, videos on MTV had no black artists in at all. And the 53rd was the specials, who, you know, like mixed. So, and then they went back to just like white stuff over and over. So, yeah, I mean, they definitely had a case to answer.
Were the first black people on MTV then?
I believe so, yeah.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you ever hear the quote from the head of MTV when someone asked him about this? They said, why are you not playing any videos by black artists? And he said, we're not here to cater to minority audiences.
Fucking hell.
I mean, that's pretty much the line that the interviewer gives David Bowie in that interview.
Yeah.
You know.
Because no white people ever like black music.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, the number of people who like Billie Jean by Michael Jackson, it's a very small minority of music fans.
Now, Michael Jackson, with this song, he essentially became the one go-to person. If ever anyone came up to you on the playground and said, what music are you into then? Who are you into? What are you? And you didn't really know. You just go, Michael Jackson.
Really?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Mm. Did you go to a mixed school, though? I went to an all-boys school.
Yes.
Right, there we go. At my school, nobody would admit to being into Michael Jackson. Absolutely no way. It was just something about that testosterone-y atmosphere that anything less heterosexual than the Jam was frowned upon, really.
Yeah, the style cancel. Oh,
yeah. No, let's not go there, man. Yeah. So, Billie Jean spent only 1 week at number one, knocked off the top spot by a single we're going to see later on. The follow-up, Beat It, got to number three for 2 weeks in April, and he'd have two more top 10 hits with Wannabe Starting Something and Thriller in the UK, as well as getting to number two with Say, 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 his duet with Paul McCartney, which featured on Macca's Pipes of Peace LP. And Steve Barron went on to direct Mike Bassett, England manager, in 2001.
What a great year it's been for Michael Jackson. Shecky's had a good year as well. A successful album, The Bop Won't Stop, and the single from that album made number three last month. Shaky Stevens is here. It's Cry, just a little bit.
Janice, who's being bothered by that blonde zoo wanker who was next to Bates last time, tells us about someone else who has bestraddled the world of pop this year like a white shod colossus. It's Shakin' Stevens, and Cry Just a Little Bit.
But hang on a second. That very strange energy in the intro, right? Mm. Janice is standing there, and they've got this really sort of more glamorous and very smug looking woman to stand next to her with one long satin glove fist on her jutting hip, smirking right into Janice's face from less than a foot away, as if to say, oh, I see you managed to get to CNA before it closed. Sort of, there's like a sort of Mean Girls vibe, right?
She wasn't giving that to Simon Bates.
Yeah, I know. But then as soon as Janice introduces Shaky, this woman just immediately melts into a big grin and throws her arms in the air in celebration. Diffuses a potentially uncomfortable situation, which is what Shakin' Stevens is all about, bringing people together.
Having women next to Janice, I don't know. I don't know how to feel about that. It wasn't all sisterly, was it?
No.
Put a man there. That what they ought to do is put a man next to her, showing her the same deference as respect as that woman showed Simon Bates.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
It's 1983, for fuck's sake. Come on, Top of the Pops, give Janice some cock.
She's not gonna want for cock though in this, or pussy. To be fair, I mean, this whole thing that you're saying, I didn't even notice. I only had eyes for Janice. And and her thighs.
Yeah, rarely seen.
She looks great. She's so saucy. Mm. And the thing is, she does look kind of like when there's like two people in fancy dress who like didn't get the memo. You know, that's kind of the look, but also it's fine because yeah.
What,
they
Simon
are
Simon Bates and Andy Peebles.
Yeah, basically, they didn't get any of the memos at all for many years, and that was not by accident, you know, and nor were they invited to this thing. So it is, you know, that's the party that I would want to go to, is the one that Janice was going to and Mike Smith. You know, that's where the party's
but
at.
But what pantomime costume would you put Simon Bates and Andy Peebles in?
Two back ends of a horse.
Yes, yes.
Or, I mean, you know, pantomime is Cinderella. Let's just leave it at that.
We covered Comrade Shaky last fucking episode, God! And this, his 22nd solo single in the UK, was the follow-up to It's Late, his cover of the Ricky Nelson song, which got to number 11 in August. It's been a quiet year by Shaky standards, but no longer, because this single, the lead cut from his new LP, The Bop Won't Stop, which was written by Bob Heatler, who gave the world Japanese Boy by Anika, came out in early November, immediately launched itself upon the charts, and spent 2 weeks at number 3 at the end of that month. It's still in the charts, actually, currently residing at number 24, and here he is in the studio, making the first of 3 appearances on the telly over the Christmas period. Oh, tidings of heterosexual comfort and joy, everyone.
Well, Christmas wouldn't be Christmas without an ageing hack putting his white shoes all over the turkey.
He did actually do that once, didn't he? Because he's got a new yes. anthology out, there was an interview that he did with, in The Guardian, I have more respect for him after reading this, actually. He was playing a company party and furious at the tepid response, it says. Yes. He reputedly climbed onto one of the dining tables, feet in food, and bellowed, "Scream, damn you! You would scream for Tom Jones, yes. You can scream for me!" yes, after that I would, actually.
That's from his biography, isn't it, that was written by his old manager?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's an amazing quote. I'm assuming there are many other amazing quotes in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, it's a very good read, that is.
Yeah.
If you're into the Welsh rock and roll scene of the early 70s, it's an essential textbook. But basically, a lot of Shaky and his mates lying about him bands with beer spilling everywhere and the occasional shag.
The occasional shag. So there's some story in there that was mentioned in that Guardian bit. I don't know if you get an answer to whether or not he snogged noted novelist Edna O'Brien at...
Yes.
Well, hang on, what?
At the birthday party of Kenneth Tynan's daughter. You know the whole, like, what, you do it for the anecdote thing, or, like, it's like, you don't even need, that's just, like...
You don't need to know any more than that, do you?
No.
That's the best Shaky story I've ever heard, I think. He pulled Edna O'Brien.
Yes.
This is the thing,
guest on the first ever Question Time.
There's more, yes. There's sort of, considering how sort of pedestrian his oeuvre is, there's some interesting shit in the margins there, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, I fundamentally don't get Shakin' Stevens because he's kind of just some bloke. He's done incredibly well and he was the biggest singles artist of the entire decade and spent longer in the charts than fucking Michael Jackson and Madonna. But yeah. I guess the thing is that he's sort of, he's a relatable pop star, isn't he? He's a reachable and sort of knowable in that way. Like, that's one of the types of pop star and one of the types of celebrity is the sort of, you know, next door, wave over the garden fence kind of pop star.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. He's a traditional seaside holiday, isn't he? I don't mean that he's end of the pier. I just mean that he's a static caravan. He's fish and chips. He's a stroll along the prom. He's... a stick of rock, you know, that's kind of what this is. I mean, this is not a great song. He's not selling it very hard either. He seems a bit tired, but I've got to give props to the outfit. That is a really good outfit. That's a very good iteration of monochrome, black shirt and trousers.
Yeah, white shoes, black strides, white coat, black shirt, white tie, black mic, white shoes, sweet Mike Barrett. There's one in every town.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it would have been enhanced by him if they'd had like a little trestle table of like a sad buffet, yes. And he'd like got up there and kicked some bolivants about. Yeah. It would have been, you know.
The thing is, though, it would be a good outfit, except unfortunately he's committed the ultimate faux pas of turning up to the Top of the Pops Christmas special wearing almost the same outfit as Simon Bates.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
And looking a bit like Mike Reed, actually. Yeah, yeah. Doesn't he look like Mike Reed a bit? He does now. Him, yes. And Mike Reed, who were the same age, almost the same age. Look, it's like, have you ever seen him in the same room? Any day of the week, I'd rather see Shaking Stevens' Hove interview than Mike Reed, but that's by the by.
Yeah, I mean, by Shaky standards, this song is practically futurist, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's got synths on it and everything.
Is it?
What's going on, Shaky? Well,
he's trying to move into the 80s with that, yes. Electronic beat. But even then, it's like a sort of 1950s electronic. It's like hello, I am rock and rolling robot. Watch me do the twist. Like with plastic concertina bits joining the limbs onto the central dustbin.
Metal Michael.
That's the switch it's meant to flip, isn't it? But it's not leaning on it very hard. I mean, there's not like a, it's not like a proper sort of rockabilly shuffle thing. It's just sort of bum-ja. And, you know, the kind of, there's sort of some key changes at particular moments, but it doesn't really go anywhere. It doesn't say an awful lot. It's meant to be like a winsome pop song about being sad, and it's meant to make you feel that particular sort of twinkly feeling of you know, melancholy 50s pop.
Yeah, but moderately sad.
Yeah, not too sad. Just a single tear rolling, you know, rolling cinematically.
A little bit of what makes you miserable does you good.
Yeah.
Is what he's saying here, isn't it?
It's true that.
He's only sad in a natural way. And he enjoys sometimes feeling this way. From the Shaking Stevens A Prestatin EP.
Yeah, Cafe Formica.
Yes.
But it is ruined by the synths, this record. Not because they're synths in themselves, but because it's got the nastiest, most tasteless early 80s synth keyboard sound. There's someone vamping all the way through it on this like ice rink like, organ sound.
Like John Shuttleworth.
Yeah, or keyboard cat, like in lieu of any audible guitar. And it's fucking brutal. It's like a nasty Yamaha preset. It sounds like a Cyberman's kazoo. And it's practically the only melodic element of the backing track. And because there's not much to this song, it sort of has to sound appealing. And it doesn't, thanks to Keyboard Cat pounding away with his stiffly outstretched paws. But it's kind of pointless digging too deep into individual Shaky works, because really, these are all extracts from a continuous performance.
Yeah.
Like, this fades down, but he doesn't stop bopping. And 3 months later, they just fade him back up again for 3 minutes, call it a different song, and there's his latest million seller. When I first watched this episode, I thought, no, I'm all shaken out now. I haven't got anything left.
No,
but
no.
There may actually be an infinite number of observations waiting to be made about Shaking Stevens. The churning engine overheating at this point as he steadfastly refuses to move from the spot.
Yeah, like he's got his heels caught in a tram line and he can't get them out.
And it's like your own heartbeat. It's as boring and samey as your own heartbeat, which you never think about until it stops. It's like the dignity of labour, because something on this show had to follow Billie Jean, right? And Shaky is the one artiste who is completely unruffled by that prospect, because it's just another day's labour for him, you know, at the coalface of self-contained
insignificance. Rock and roll.
Yeah, and I love that about him, because he has no self-importance and he has no need to communicate anything.
No.
Or to be
just,
part.
Here I am again.
Yeah.
Shaking for you,
yeah,
mama.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
It's just food on the table and one more hooligan off the street.
Yeah, that must be part of the appeal, is just the sheer reliability of him. He is completely, you know, it's a crazy world, but that's one thing that you can rely on is Shaking Stevens.
I'll tell you what he makes me think of. He's like one of those boxers who only exists to lose. You know, the blokes they wheel in to fight serious boxers who are on their way up so they can put together...
Or the jobbers in wrestling.
Is that the same thing?
Yeah.
Because you know how boxers, like, when they get to title fights, and it's like he's unbeaten for 20 fights, and it's because they brought in these cauliflower ear motherfuckers to fight him. You know, you meet him and they're like, "Yo, I fought Klitschko, I fought Joshua in a pub in Forest Gate," and it's like, "Well, did you win?" "No, I was neither able nor allowed to win." And it's Shaky. I don't know. He reminds me of that a bit. He's always happy to pad out the undercard. You know, and make up the numbers. And you have to have him there. It can't all be solid greatness, because you would get bored and there would be no winners and losers, you know.
Well, this is Top of the Pops doing something for the old uns, aren't they, in this episode? Because it's supposed to be a family show, remember?
Yes, but also, even in the context of Top of the Pops, if Wham and Frankie Goes to Hollywood are to seem as thrilling as they should, you've got to have a Shaky. You know, and it takes a certain amount of skill and guts to play that role. You know, just standing there every 3 months, getting the crap punched out of your eyeballs by Michael Jackson and Freeze. You know, it's a tough but a noble way to make a living.
Yeah. Well, it is noble. It's not like you know, much as I don't have a lot of feeling for him, he's not pathetic. You know, there is a dignity there. He is now, you know, singing kind of socially distanced one song gigs at Euston for secondary royals, you know, having a nice time and going, "Oh, that was great."
Comrade Shaky consorting with the royal family. That ain't right. Quisling Stevens.
But, you know, I'm pleased. Every interview I read with him now, just he sounds like a stand-up guy, and he's had a great career, and people love him, and he's massive in Poland, and apparently so he's got this 19 CD anthology out now and like a singles collection.
Yeah, I know this because every single time I go on YouTube, I get adverts for it, targeted, no doubt.
I'm afraid this.
But you know, but people rag on Shaky for a perceived lack of imagination, but. Do you know what he's called, his singles compilation? Yeah? It's called Singled Out. Did you get it? Do you get it? Oh. No, say yes. Do you get it? Say yes. Say yes.
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 Yeah.
And apparently he signed so many copies of, he went to the record company and signed so many copies of his mighty works that until his hand bled.
Oh.
What a pro.
That's almost the quintessential Shaky story, isn't it? He just did a mundane thing until his hand bled, and you've got to hand it to him.
You do, in fact, have to drippingly hand it to him. But yeah, just my final word on Shaky is that my bloke's mate used to be his sound tech, like about 10 years ago.
Right,
had to do his monitors, and the whole of the road crew signed a contract that you had to call him Shaky.
Oh, yes!
That's how he had to be addressed. Not Mr. Shakes, not Lord Shakington, not Mr. Stevens, not his shakeliness, but Shaky.
Oh, wow.
So it's weird that, because it's such a weird combination of, like, arrogance and humility.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to, please call me Shaky, but hey, call me Shaky. But, like, it's sign here. And like, imagine the look you'd get if I don't know, Mr. Shaking.
Well, we saw what happened to Richard Madeley when he called it.
Yes.
Right? Yes.
Although, to be fair, Shaky had spent the afternoon with Status Quo and the contents of Rick Parfitt's inside jacket pocket.
Allegedly.
Shaky's new LP, Can't Stop the Bop, but it may have been coated down by the capitalist imperious melody maker. But at the end of the cassette version of The Bot Won't Stop, something quite remarkable happens, doesn't it, Telly? Shaky grasps the white heat of technology. You get this message from Comrade Shaky.
Hi, this is Shaky. If you've got a Sinclair Spectrum 48K computer, Why don't you try my game? The program follows shortly. If you haven't, please fast forward to the end of the tape so that you can listen to the album again.
The Shaky Game.
Yes.
For the, if you've got a Spectrum.
You've got a Sinclair Spectrum 48K computer.
Mm.
Yeah, I think I can tell you right now who hasn't got one.
Yes.
It's the worst computer game of all time. The story is the programmers had never programmed a game before.
No.
And never did again.
No.
And were given about 3 weeks to do it. It's about vampires and bats chasing you, which is a deeply unshaky-like theme.
No.
It's as if they'd written the Bauhaus game, but Bauhaus didn't want it. So they just offered it to Shaky. But they tried to bolt it on to Shakin' Stevens.
Mm.
The first thing that happens is a text screen comes up and it says, "Hi, I'm Shaky. It's late."
So even Clive Sinclair has to address him by Shaky.
"It's late, close to midnight," which is not many people realise. If you bought the cassette of Thriller, it had a game at the end on it for the VIC-20 where you had to fix the shingles and find time to fix the floor before you got savaged by the hot dog. What happens in Shaky's game is you have to reach the old house of vampires. Before, he says, "You have to help me reach the old house of vampires before my fuel runs out. Watch out for the flying bats. They will drive you crazy." Of course, when you actually see it, it makes the infamously pointless and headachy Paul McCartney "Give My Regards to Broad Street" game look like Red Dead Redemption 2. It's just some lines in a square maze around a house, which is supposed to be this old house, although it looks like a Barrett new build.
Yes.
And there's a little racing car going around it, which is you driving Shaky to the old house. And some bat-shaped things moving around, and you go bleep, 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 until you get to the house.
No soundtrack or anything.
There is sound.
But not a really nasty version of "This Old House" or something. Like in that Minder game where they did "I Could Be So Good For You."
That's fucking brilliant.
Yes,
the version of "I Could Be So Good For You" in that Minder game is the best version ever. Of the two, it's the best version ever. No, what you're hearing is not gently pasteurized rockabilly music.
No.
It's this hideous Ipcress file frequency assault that attacks the alpha rhythms of your brain and that makes you go out and assassinate someone without knowing you're doing it, you know. So you get to the old house in your car with Shaky, which takes about 9 seconds.
If you're good.
And then a sort of teletext level rendering of Shaky's face appears on the screen with a speech bubble saying, "You're at the old house," and that's the end of the game.
Yes.
And then it just starts again a bit faster. Or if on the way you collide with one of the bats, you get the same Shaky face, but this time the speech bubble says, "Oh dear, a bat bit you." In an eerie foreshadowing of the mess we're all in.
Oh,
right,
Christ.
Now.
You have died of bat bite.
I don't understand, more than anything else, why Shaky wants to go to the old house if it's full of vampires.
Yeah.
Where's the appeal? He doesn't like the vampire bats, but he likes the vampires. You know what I mean? I would say that that's a good explanation of why you ain't going to need this old house no longer.
No.
Not where you want to go. Unless it is Shaky Stevens' vampire killer and he's got like a massive jeweled crucifix. And he's just going to, you know, cut a swathe through these swooning black caped figures. I don't know, but that sounds like a better game than the one that we're playing. I don't know why you needed a Sinclair Spectrum 48K computer to play it, because looks like it would have run just as well on a kettle.
And I don't know why they think the kind of person who would have a Sinclair Spectrum 48K in 1983 would want to buy a Shaking Stevens tape.
It's 48K, Al.
Oh, sorry, 4-8K. Oh. Do apologise. I just imagine Shaking Stevens, core audience, ignoring all that, and then all of a sudden it goes... and thinking, what? Oh, fucking hell, what's going on with Shaker? But I do have to say, that track is David Stubbs' favourite Shaking Stevens track. He wrote a chapter about it in his book, I think.
It just sounds like it's like the golf game that Bart Simpson gets that is yes. a terrific disappointment. Yeah. And like, imagine it trying to get the car to go faster or like try and get yourself bitten by a bat just to see what happens. Like, you have selected power drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of Simpsons, Shaky's spoken intro is, I've never heard anything more like Krusty the Clown doing the voice yes. for the Krusty doll. It's just like, hi, I'm Shaky. Really want a drink yes. is the game. No, allegedly.
But later that night on ITV, Comrade Shaky dropped the Tsar Bomber of heterosexual rock and roll when he unveiled his follow-up single, A Rockin' Good Way, with none other than Bonnie Tyler for an unprecedented show of Welsh force on Jimmy Tarbuck's Christmas All-Stars. That single would be released a mere 5 days from today and eventually got to number 5 for 2 weeks in January. But it wouldn't be the last time Comrade Shaky made himself available to the proletariat over Christmas, because on Boxing Day, he would be the special guest of the Keith Harris Christmas Party. Mingling with Orville... Listen to this list, man. Mingling with Orville, Cuddles, Dippy the Dinosaur, Stu Francis, The Green Goddess, Mike Reed, John Craven, Fern Britton, Janet Ellis, Floella Benjamin, outside of the dustbin, Ian McCaskill, Patrick Moore, and Simon Bates. And whoever else was knocking around the BBC bar at the time.
I always think with Keith Harris, he never really found his role in life until he changed his name to Bend Over.
Man, the party's getting properly started now. Simon's over there on the decks pumping out some proper pricey bangers. Sarah and Neil have nipped to the beer off before it shuts, and me and Taylor have got the urge to flap the fish. So, you nip out the back garden for a bit, come and rejoin us for part 3 of this massive episode of Chart Music. Don't set the neighbours off, don't piss up against my back wall, and stay pop crazed.
Chart Music.
GreatBigOwl.com. It's an S-Pod thing. The podcast revisiting S Club 7's insane TV show.
Yeah, I can't imagine anyone's binge-watched this. Anyone who's not on drugs.
Thank you for bringing this into my life. It was honestly truly appalling.
Guests helped me analyse the show in more detail than anyone ever asked for.
It feels weird to me to say the phrase sex object in a show that was aimed at six-year-olds.
Do you think there's one of the problems with the show is that 7 is too much?
It's an S-Pod thing from Great Big Owl.